If you have heard a talk from me before, you probably heard me say that the ecological crisis is the greatest crisis in the history of our species. So in this context, we naturally want to know, you know, what does Buddhism have to offer that can help us understand and respond? Especially because Buddhism, all Buddhist traditions are pre-modern, developed way before modernity, way before the kind of problem that we have today. So they don't have specific answers, but there are lots of implications that can be sort of teased out. And I gave a couple talks earlier this year to this group, developing one of those implications. This fascinating parallel, fascinating at least to me, between what Buddhism has always said about our individual predicament, the delusion of a self that feels separate from the other people, feels separate from the rest of the natural world. Parallel between that and our collective situation today, the fact that we as a species feel ourselves to be separate from not only other species, but basically from the rest of the natural world. So I think that's one really important implication. Another one that I probably talk about the most is the Bodhisattva path. That the Bodhisattva path, I think, is very naturally developed. We can call it the Ecosattva path, a path that, double path, whereby we continue to work on our own personal transformation, but also we do what we can to engage with the ecological crisis and other aspects of the poly crisis that we have today. So those are some kind of natural implications of the Buddhist tradition that I think can help us understand our ecological crisis. But today, what I'd like to do is kind of go back to a baseline. What does Buddhism really say about our natural world? You would think that'd be a natural place to start, right? A nice, simple question, but it turns out that there is no simple answer for the simple reason that there's no such simple thing as Buddhism, right? In comparison with something like, say, Christianity, which, you know, for a long time, we just had one type of Christianity, Roman Catholicism with the Vatican. In the case of Buddhism, in line with its own emphasis on impermanence and insubstantiality, right? The emphasis, everything is changing. This has also been true for Buddhism. We see how Buddhism has changed quite remarkably, especially when it has spread to new cultures, new places, new lands. For example, Tibetan Buddhism, the Buddha never taught Tibetan Buddhism, right? Tibetan Buddhism is what developed when Tantric Buddhism from India spread to the native Bun shamanism of Tibet, and it was the interaction among them that created what we know as Tibetan Buddhism today. And the same thing with Chan, or Zen, as we call it in Japan. The Buddha never taught Chan, really. Chan was what developed in China when Mahayana Buddhism spread to China and it encountered the indigenous Taoist tradition. Other traditions too, but especially Taoism. There's kind of a natural affinity there. Okay. Of course, it raises really interesting questions, doesn't it? What happens to Buddhism now that it spreads to, you know, to the West or to the modern world, to a world in crisis? How might Buddhism change? How might Buddhism need to change? But let's go back. Let's go back to the origins so far as we can and consider, right? What does Buddhism say about the natural world? Starting with the Buddha. What did the Buddha say about the natural world? The short answer is, we don't know. Not really, right? I mean, the Buddha lived, maybe 2,400 years ago, and nothing was written down for 200 to 300 years. Of course, you had an oral tradition. The monks were really good at memorizing the teachings. Thank goodness. But the idea that they just recorded them perfectly and nothing was altered, frankly, I find that kind of hard to believe. We don't know what was lost. We don't know really what was added, what was altered, what may have been misunderstood. The earliest we have is the Pali Canon. And in this case, the Nikayas, the teachings, voluminous, many times longer than the whole of the Bible. Another reason why it's hard to believe that they were just memorized and passed down perfectly for so many centuries. What does the Pali Canon, the fundamental teachings of the Theravada, Pali Canon of Southeast Asia, what do those teachings have to say about the natural world? Let me read you a quotation from a scholar. On account of the Buddha's focus on transcending this world, right? The idea that nirvana involves transcending this world of samsara, this world of craving, delusion, suffering, right? On account of the Buddha's focus on transcending this world, it's understandable that his teachings don't focus on, much less romanticize, nature. Rather, early Buddhist texts are openly hostile to the environment. In the Digha Nikaya, for example, Buddhists are told to generate a distaste for the world, for this world, because it's impermanent. Since the ultimate aim of Buddhism is to transcend this world, it makes sense that not too much energy is to be spent glorifying it. When the goal is nirvana, there's very little motivation for the preservation of nature. One can search the early Buddhist canon in vain for anything that could be interpreted as an appreciation of nature. If nature is ever employed in early Buddhist texts, it is almost always in terms of impermanence, decay, and as something to be avoided, something to be escaped. This is by a scholar named Elverskog, right? John Elverskog. Actually, I think he's a little bit extreme here, and he's missing some texts that are, you know, some of the early texts and the earliest teachings that are rather more positive toward the natural world. For example, it's interesting that one of the many rules and regulations that the Buddha set up for the monastics is that they shouldn't cut down trees or cut down branches of living trees or even pluck a green leaf, a still living leaf from a tree. You know, all of which suggests to me rather more appreciation and concern for the natural world. A more positive attitude. And there are some counterexamples. For example, in the Theragatha, which contains the verses, the exclamations of Buddhist nuns, right? But not just the nuns. The Arhat, so fully enlightened Mahakashapa, or Mahakashapa, he talks about how much he appreciates the natural world. Quote, "Those upland glades delightful to the soul, where the Kaveri spreads its wildering wreaths." I think the Kaveri is a river, actually. "Where sound the trumpet calls of elephants, those are the hills wherein my soul delights." Kind of loose translation, given that Buddhism doesn't usually talk about the soul. But, you know, and then he goes on and on. There's a long sort of poem, which all of which ends, "These are the places wherein I fully delight." You know, so I think Elverskog is a little bit one-dimensional here, but nonetheless, he's on to something important, and for the most part, he's right. Despite these passages, there are many more in the Pali Canon that emphasize the natural world, including our bodies, right, which are part of the natural world. They're problematical in the sense that they can't provide the kind of happiness that we seek, and therefore we shouldn't cherish them, right? Instead, as he said, we're encouraged to become disenchanted with samsara, this world of samsara. Both the natural world, no matter how beautiful it may be, including our bodies, right? They must be transcended to attain nibbana, the final goal that ends rebirth into this world. So from the beginning, there's kind of a problematical attitude toward this world. So much for the Pali Canon. But again, there's lots of other Buddhist traditions. For example, Tibetan Buddhism. Now, this I find quite puzzling. You know, when you think about, say, India and Southeast Asia, you think of lush jungles and sands and, you know, beaches. It's lush, very beautiful. And yet, the attitude toward nature is actually more positive in Tibetan Buddhism, right? Tibet, very high, very dry, very cold, windswept, not nearly as beautiful as Southeast Asia, but in fact, some of the Tibetan Buddhist teachings offer us a much more positive view. For example, Shantideva, one of the great teachers, in his Bodhicaryavatara, celebrates the happiness of a solitary life in nature. Quote, "When shall I withdraw into the forest and live among the trees with birds and deer who say nothing unpleasant, but are a joy to live with?" I think that's saying something about life in the monastery too, right? He got tired of his fellow monastics gossiping or whatever. Another important Tibetan book, right? The famous 100,000 Songs of Milarepa, the great yogi. It's even more fulsome in its praise of nature. Quote, "This is a delightful place, a place of hills and forests. In the mountain meadows, flowers bloom. In the woods, dance the swaying trees. For monkeys, it's a playground. Birds sing tunefully, bees fly and buzz. And from day until night, the rainbows come and go. In summer and winter falls the sweet rain, and mist and fog roll up in fall and spring. At such a pleasant place in solitude, I, Milarepa, happily abide, meditating on the void-illuminating mind." He makes his cave sound pretty attractive, right? Yeah. But what about our stinking bodies, right? I mean, some of the earlier teachings sort of emphasize, you know, they're full of piss and shit and phlegm and all these things. We shouldn't get attached to them. It's no coincidence, I think, that Tibetan Buddhism not only has a more positive attitude toward nature generally, but a more positive attitude toward our bodies, right? The goal of Tibetan tantric practices isn't to escape our human bodies, but to transform them so that we experience them differently, so we are them differently, right? As one of the tantra says, without bodily form, how could there be bliss? So using mantras and mudras and other types of meditation, the idea is to transform our body into the Buddha's body, or the body the way that the Buddha experienced it, right? A Vajra body. The Vajra can be translated as thunderbolt or a thunder, or as a diamond body, same as the Buddha's body. Interesting contrast, yeah? Other Buddhist traditions offer different variations on this relationship, this attitude toward the natural world and our bodies as part of the natural world. So, for example, some Mahayana texts go further and they emphasize, and I'm going to keep coming back to this, the non-duality between our bodies and the earth, right? For example, one of the most important Mahayana sutras, the Avatamsaka, says, quote, "All lands are my body, and so are the Buddhas living there. Watch my pores, and I will show you the Buddha's realm." Within Chan or Zen Buddhism, which is my own practice tradition, maybe the clearest expression of this non-duality, or our non-duality with the natural world, is by the great 13th century Japanese Zen master Dogen Kigen. Quote from his Shobogenzo, right? "The entire world is nothing but the true human body." This is interesting because Dogen is also very famous for quoting, for saying something similar about our minds. And this is very precious to me because there's a story that my own Zen teacher, Yamada Koen Roshi, was enlightened or had his deep experience when he came across this quotation from Dogen. Quote, "I came to realize clearly that mind is nothing other than mountains and rivers and the great wide earth, the sun and the moon and the stars." Interesting, not making a distinction between mind and body there. In the Genjo Koan fascicle, one of the Dharma talks included in his great book, The Shobogenzo, he famously summarized the process whereby we can wake up and realize this non-duality of self and world, right? Quote, "To study the Buddha Dharma, to study the way of enlightenment, is to study the self." Study here, not in our academic sense, but in the sense of inquire into, right? "To study the way of enlightenment, Buddha Dharma, is to study the self." And then he continues, "To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the 10,000 things. When actualized by these 10,000 things, your body and mind, as well as the body and minds of everyone else, drop away." Interesting question. Is he talking about transcendence or transformation? Or, you know, what's the difference? Transcendence, there's the idea you transcend this world. Maybe transformation is experiencing this world in a different way. Dogen's own enlightenment experience is one of the most famous stories in Japanese Buddhism, right? He traveled to China and he was practicing under a Chinese master, Zhu Qing. And there was a famous story. So once they're all meditating together in this large group, monks, Chinese monks, and one of the monks was kind of nodding off. And Zhu Qing reprimanded him. He said, "To practice Chan, Zen, right, is to cast off body and mind, to let go of body and mind." And when Dogen heard this, that was it. He was able to do that. And then soon after, he had a private interview with Zhu Qing, who Zhu Qing actually approved of him. How would we say it? Zhu Qing affirmed his realization, right? Body and mind, your body and mind are cast off. And Dogen said, "Well, wait a minute, don't grant the seal of your approval too quickly." And Zhu Qing said, And I love this. Cast off, casting off. Datsuraku, datsuraku. It's right. You've cast off your body and mind. Now stop casting off. I mean, what's he getting at there? You know, he's saying you don't have to fully transcend your body, mind, right? Just realize them in a non-dual way, we can say, in a different way. Cast off, casting off. When the body mind is cast off, the result isn't some disembodied consciousness, but a cast off body mind, a let go body and mind, a transformed body and mind. Again, from this perspective, the idea is not, as we so often think in religion generally, to transcend, right? Transcend this world, transcend our bodies, but to transform, to experience them in a different way. I'm reminded here of a rather pregnant remark by the great mythologist Joseph Campbell. Quote, "Every religion is true one way or another. True when it's understood metaphorically. But when it gets stuck in its own metaphors, when it interprets them as facts, then you're in trouble." You know, I think he's talking about the difference. Well, one of the things he's talking about is the difference between transformation and transcendence. That if we take it too literally, we think that what we have to escape and negate is this world. And maybe all of that talk about transcendence is really talk about transcending our usual way of experiencing the world, our usual way of experiencing our bodies, our usual way of experiencing the natural world, right? Perhaps there's nowhere else to go, nothing else that needs to be attained than this casting off. As the 18th century Japanese Zen master, again, one of the most famous, Hakuin, right? He has a famous song that in Zen centers we recited, a kind of a short sutra. He said, "Truly, is anything missing now? Nirvana is right here before our eyes. This very place is the lotus land. This very body, the Buddha." Because many of us here were raised as Christians and were quite familiar with that, we're often reacting against it, I want to mention a kind of what I think is a pretty profound parallel between what I've just been trying to say and what happened in Christianity, because I think it's the same kind of thing. I wonder if Christianity also got misinterpreted here, right? What am I talking about? Well, maybe you know the Lord's Prayer, both in Matthew and Luke, right? "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." It seems to anticipate an apocalypse, which in fact, you know, many people believed, whether or not Jesus did, it's not clear. But many people believe he was going to return soon to the earth, and there would be this, you know, transformation, and people who had died would come back to life, and so forth, right? But according to some scholars, such as Crossan, this predicted second coming of Christ was actually a mistake, a misinterpretation, a distortion of the teachings. Interesting, right? The kingdom of God wasn't an imminent end of this world, but a reality here and now for those who can perceive it. As it says in Luke, "Once on being asked by the Pharisees when the kingdom of God would come, Jesus replied, 'The coming of the kingdom of God isn't something that can be observed, nor will people say, here it is or there it is, because the kingdom of God is among you. The kingdom of God is in your midst.'" And the Gospel of Thomas, another, you know, it's like there were all these Gospels, lots of Gospels, not just the four that we know. And the four were made, it was a political decision, but there were these other Gospels, like the Gospel of Thomas, maybe the most important. That kind of reinforces. When you look forward, what you look forward to has already come, but you don't recognize it. And the kingdom of the Father is spread out upon the earth, and people do not see it. Is Jesus maybe saying something similar here? But somehow the focus, as it became institutionalized, the focus shifted to some last judgment in the future, right? In both cases, we seem to end up with this kind of ontological dualism between this world, for Buddhism, right, samsara, the world of suffering and so forth, this world and a higher world, a better world, a world that we go to after we die. And inevitably, then there's some devaluation of this world. It's just a means to qualify for somewhere better in both traditions. And the question these texts raise is this somehow a misinterpretation? Does this make any sense? Yeah. This tension, returning to Buddhism now, this tension between a more literal understanding of the Buddhist goal, right, transcending samsara, versus transformation, so that what we transcend is just our usual way of experiencing this world. This interesting tension between the two is also found in the Pure Land traditions of Mahayana Buddhism. The Pure Land traditions, more devotional. And these are the main traditions of East Asia, by the way. You know, in countries like Korea or Japan, you know, Chan, Zen, it always attracted a fairly small number of people. The main Buddhist traditions in East Asia are Pure Land. But there's an interesting tension. Here we go again, right? Two main views. According to the Western direction Pure Land teachings, these are the teachings of Chinese masters Tan Luan, Dao Chu, Sheng Dao, right? The Pure Land, what is it? It's another realm where we can be reborn if we have faith in Amida Buddha. When we die, Amida Buddha will meet us and he'll take us to his Pure Land. And the point about the Pure Land is not Nirvana itself, but it's a really nice place where it's very easy to meditate. And from there, it's easier to kind of attain Nirvana. That's the idea. And this approach, this understanding of the Pure Land, usually emphasizes how magnificent, right? You'll have great descriptions of how fantastic the Pure Land is and all that as a way to arouse our desire to qualify for it, right? But there's another Pure Land tradition, right? The mind-only Pure Land tradition, which claimed this world, including, of course, the natural world, this is the Pure Land, right? It's the one that Hakuin, that little quotation, you know, the Pure Land is right here, right? We perceive this world as impure only because of our own minds, which we project. In fact, that we're living in the Pure Land all the time. There's nowhere better to go. Reminds me of this wonderful little poem by the Korean poet Ko Eun. I may have quoted it last time, right? There is no secret teaching, no Pure Land, just this dirty world with its endless opportunities to be kind. Maybe he's not really denying the Pure Land, but he's denying a kind of transcendental understanding of that. Anyway, of course, the difference between these two versions of the Pure Land, it has significant ecological implications, doesn't it? Significant implications for our understanding and response to the ecological crisis, right? And, you know, going back to what Elverskog said, if the goal is to transcend this world, if this world just has value as a place where we qualify for something better, for Christianity, our ultimate destiny, heaven or hell, whatever, then it does, you know, taking care of this world doesn't seem quite so important, right? It's just a necessary means, but our destination is somewhere else. But if the goal is to experience this world, including our bodies, in a different way, which in Zen we talk about realizing our true nature here and now, then you could say that the well-being, the health of the natural world becomes a lot more important. And in fact, if our goal is realizing our non-duality with the world, that the whole earth is, in fact, our own body, as Dogen says, then you would think that the health of its ecosystems should be our preeminent concern, right? What could be more important than healing our relationship with the natural world, with the biosphere, both physically and spiritually? I'm reminded of this quotation from the Tao Te Ching, you know, Lao Tzu. Those who love the world as their own body can be entrusted with the world. And of course, that gives me an opportunity to plug my new book again. There's a new book coming out next year with the title, Loving the World as Our Own Body. Yeah. Okay. Shifting gears, let me talk about what's called Bhumi Sparsha. Bhumi Sparsha refers to a particular image of the Buddha, and my guess is that probably all of us at one time or the other have seen it. The Buddha is sitting cross-legged, and his left hand is in his lap, but his right hand is touching the earth, or sometimes it's touching the lotus throne that he's sitting on, which is in effect the same thing. It's touching the earth. It's called the Bhumi Sparsha Mudra, the Earth Witness Pose. And what this pose is commemorating is a particular incident just before the Buddha's great enlightenment, right? According to the usual story, Mara, right, the symbol of evil, Mara, was trying to stop the Buddha from getting enlightened. So he tried to intimidate them first by, actually, I forget which is first. I know he sent his demons and to attack the Buddha, and that didn't work. And he sent his beautiful daughters to seduce the Buddha, and that didn't work. I'm not sure which was worse, which was first there. And when neither of those ploys worked, Mara confronted the Buddha, and he said, well, you know, you don't have the right to sit on this seat of enlightenment. This is the seat where all of the previous Buddhas became enlightened, but you don't have the right to sit there. I should be sitting there. And the Buddha and Mara had all of his hosts behind him, right? And they're all saying, They're all supporting Mara, and the Buddha's there by himself. Who supports the Buddha? He touched the earth, right? The earth is my witness. And at that point, the earth roared. I bear you witness. And at that point, Mara and all of his throngs disappeared. And the Buddha continued to sit there throughout that night and attain great awakening. Right? That's the story. It's a nice story, I think, but what does it mean? Is it an eco-dharma story? The first thing to realize about this story, actually, it's not canonical. It's not in the original teachings. It was added later. One of the myths, one of the legends, right? And I actually talked to Bhikkhu Bodhi about this. He's my reference for in the Pali Canon. And he kindly replied, he said, yeah, it's not in the Pali Canon. In fact, the way it's told, it's not really an Ecodharma story, right? He said, quote, the Bodhisattva here, that's the future Buddha, he's not advocating a particular line of earth-sustaining practices. It's that he's accumulated lots of merit from his past lifetimes. That's why he deserves to sit there. Okay, so we have this story added later. What do we make of it? Especially this emphasis in the original story about, well, the Buddha's accumulated so much merit from all of his self-sacrificing deeds in previous lifetime. And I have to say, I've always had trouble understanding karma in terms of this accumulation of merit stuff. So that also gives me a little sort of... But what does it mean? Can we... It's like, what does it mean? Should we ignore the story because it's not really... Because it's not canonical? Or might we actually understand it in a different kind of way? Right? Remember, Buddhism emphasizes impermanence, insubstantiality, and that applies to Buddhism itself. Buddhism transforming, responding appropriately to new circumstances. And I'm interested in the possibility of a new way of understanding the story because I'm a bit inspired by the Christian theologian Paul Tillich, right, who offered what he called a theology of correlation. He said, quote, the answers that a religion has to offer should correspond to the questions that a culture is asking. And if it fails to do this, then the religion becomes irrelevant. So maybe we need to understand Buddhist teachings in light of this Pali crisis that we're facing today, right? So how might Buddhism respond today to this now global civilization self-destructing, right? In other words, can we take this touching the earth as an Ecodharma teaching symbol? Does it offer us an opportunity for what Christian theologians sometimes talk about as creative theology? Let me try. When the Buddha touched the earth, what was going on? Well, we can say a human body composed of basic elements, right? Carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, calcium, nitrogen, etc. That human body came in contact with a larger body, the earth, composed of much the same elements. But of course, that dualistic way of expressing it, two separate things, overlooks the interdependence of those two things, right? The interdependence of the biosphere's millions and millions of species, right? I mean, just think about it. What do we learn in grade school about oxygen and carbon dioxide, right? Our dependence on plants and vice versa. We need their oxygen, they need our carbon dioxide, and so forth, right? As Dogen said, the whole earth is indeed our body in that sense, right? We're part of this greater body. And when we touch the earth, then, aren't we caressing our own body? Arguably, one of the great causes of the ecological crisis has been our focus on wanting to transcend this world by qualifying for somewhere better, right? After we die. It's interesting that the English word nature comes from the Latin natura and its participle natus, which literally means to be born, right? The natural world is the place where things are born, but also things that are born die. When we don't like that part of it, right? We don't like that implication. To that extent, we don't want to be the same as other things in nature. We want to transcend nature. We want to be better. We want to have pure souls that are immortal and so forth, right? The idea of transcendence, literally rising above. That, of course, addresses our fear of death. We love to be assured that we don't really die. But at the cost of enshrining this terrible duality that devalues this world, because this other place we can go to is so much better, right? A deception, I think, that we can no longer afford and that our spiritual traditions need to question. So in other words, I'm wondering, maybe we should replace this traditional metaphor, transcending, right? Literally rising above, right? Rising above the natural world. Should we replace that with a different, maybe even the opposite metaphor? Descending back into the earth, right? Returning to the generative mother of all life, right? Settle back into our bodies, the fallen away, cast off body, right? To become fully embodied, right? And I wonder too, if we can push the boomy, sparsha story even a little further, and this is where I like to get speculative, and maybe that's what we need today, right? Going back to the Buddha's touching the earth, when the Buddha became awakened, right? When he was awakened, became fully enlightened, can we say that it was the earth itself that woke up? What I'm responding to here is this old problem of anatta, right? The famous Buddhist teaching, anatta, literally no self. That enlightenment is realizing that there's no separate self. Well, here's the question. If there's no separate self, then who is it or what is it that wakes up? Given what's now known about biology, including DNA, and the evolution of all life from this single-celled universal ancestor, that way of looking at enlightenment doesn't seem all that far-fetched to me, in which case, touching the earth becomes a really compelling metaphor, I think, for realizing our non-duality with the earth. To quote Campbell again, if you will think of ourselves as coming out of the earth rather than having been thrown in here from somewhere else, you see that we are the earth. We are the consciousness of the earth. These are the eyes of the earth. And this is the voice of the earth. This is Joseph Campbell. Now, if Buddhism can be understood this way, it seems to me that we're talking about something more than just Buddhism. We recuperate an ancient belief rooted in many indigenous traditions. For example, Alcibiades, an indigenous elder in Colombia, right? The indigenous elder in an Amazonian place. Quote, he said, "We cannot speak of our relation to the land because we are the land. We are the land made human." We could say we are the land become conscious. They have tried to turn us into persons, but we have chosen to remain natural as part of the earth. And there's a lovely Navajo song. It is lovely indeed, I am the spirit within the earth. The feet of the earth are my feet. The legs of the earth are my legs. The bodily strength of the earth is my strength. The thoughts of the earth are my thoughts. The voice of the earth is my voice. All that belongs to the earth belongs to me. All that surrounds the earth surrounds me. I am the sacred words of the earth. It is lovely indeed. Lovely indeed. If this is true, the implication, it seems to me, is that to take care of the earth, to take care of the biosphere, its ecosystems, of course, is to take care of ourselves. A contemporary philosopher, Irvin Laszlo, says that this non-dual perspective is consistent with what he calls the newly emerging post-materialist paradigm, which also happens to be the traditional pre-modern paradigm, he says. Quote, at the cutting edge of contemporary science, a remarkable insight is surfacing. The universe, with all things in it, is a quasi-living, coherent whole. All things in it are connected. Well, nothing new to Buddhism, right? A cosmos that's connected, coherent, and whole recalls an ancient notion that was present in the tradition of every civilization. It is an enchanted cosmos. We are part of each other, he says, and of nature. We are a conscious part of the world, a being through which the cosmos comes to know itself. We are at home in the universe. Wow, to be at home in the universe, what would that feel like? Is that an aspect, an essential aspect of the awakening that Buddhism talks about? One fascinating implication for me, at least I find this fascinating, of this new paradigm, another bit of creative theology, is the possibility of understanding evolution in the broadest sense, right? Evolution of stars, evolution of biosphere, evolution, social evolution, and all that. The possibility of understanding evolution as the creative groping of a self-organizing cosmos that is becoming more self-aware. In The Universe Story, a book by Thomas Berry and Brian Swim, they make this point more poetically, right? They say, quote, the mind that searches for contact with the Milky Way is the very mind of the Milky Way galaxy in search of its inner depths, right? When we're looking, maybe some moonless night, we're looking up at the Milky Way, those billions of stars in our galaxy, and we're wondering what it's all about. Well, we're products of that Milky Way. We're part of it. This is how the Milky Way wonders about what the Milky Way is all about, right? Wow. Thomas Berry concludes that humans can be defined as, quote, that being in whom the universe reflects on and celebrates itself in a special mode of conscious awareness. And he actually says, we are the self-consciousness of the universe. We are the universe become conscious. Very different from transcending, right? Let's not be reborn, trying to go somewhere better, right? Very different. Transformation, not avoiding rebirth. To awaken in that case would be to realize that you know, I am not something inside the body looking out through the eyes at a world that's separate from me. But I, each of us, is what the whole universe, our bigger body, our true body, is doing. Right here and now. One of the countless ways that the totality of its causes and conditions is manifesting. In light of the ecological crisis and what's needed for us, shouldn't that become the goal of religion today? To help us understand that, to help us realize that, in which case our response to the ecological crisis, we're obviously going to want to take care of it, because who doesn't want to take care of his or her own body? Thank you very much.